Welcome to Empires, an Asian business podcast. I'm your producer, Guang Jin. In previous episodes, we have explored the journey of Grab's rise to prominence. We look back at its humble beginnings, when Anthony Tan had to offer free meals to attract drivers, and trace its trajectory to a significant milestone in 2018. The acquisition of Uber's Southeast Asian operations. Today, we'll focus on what happened after the acquisition. Joined first by Jeremy, a VC of Monk's Hill Ventures, and Jason, a former investor for a pension fund and family office in Malaysia. Let's dive right in with Jeremy, who will share more about what happened after the acquisition. So thanks again, Jeremy, for joining us. And I know that you're probably tired of introducing yourself every single time. But to the benefit of the listeners who might not know, could you share a little bit about who you are and what do you do?
Hi, I'm excited to share my thoughts. I am Jeremy. I'm a founder turned VC. I built two companies along the way, one of which was acquired. And I currently am a VC with Monk's Hill Ventures. I also am the host of the Brave Southeast Asia Tech Podcast, www.bravesea.com, with over 30,000 monthly listeners, with resources, training, and content for founders and VCs.
So to all the listeners at home, they would have heard about Grab and essentially stopped right at the point where Grab acquired Uber. And that happened a couple of years ago. So now let's talk about post-acquisition with the benefit of hindsight, right? Firstly, let's talk about post-acquisition for Grab. How has Grab transformed since the acquisition?
The acquisition was a really surprising thing. I remember at that time, many of my friends who were working on either side of the divide, in either Gojek, Grab, as well as Uber, who were very unpleasantly surprised or pleasantly surprised by the announcement of the acquisition of Uber's operations across Southeast Asia and then being acquired by Grab. And I think there was a lot of distress because I think there was a very strong sense of competition. But also, I think there's also a strong sense of optimism, actually, by both sides that they were going to eventually come out on top. So the Uber team that I knew were very much very clear. They felt it was tough going, but there was a path for them to succeed. And similarly for the Grab team, I think they felt they were worthy competitors and they were also fighting to succeed. But I think nobody really envisioned it. And it was very much a shock at that point of time. Now that we've taken a step back and we've seen how the story has played out over the years, I think we've actually seen that the acquisition has turned out to be a really smart decision by the Uber headquarters in the US. If today we understand that it's a smart move, why was it so unclear back then? I think what's really changed is that between then and now has been a very much more deeper understanding about network effects and what it means for winner takes all platforms. What I mean by that is that I think there's a very straightforward understanding that one of the big advantages of internet services, especially all of these like sharing economy platforms, was a very simple concept, which was about network effects, which is that the more people join your platform, the better the product becomes for other people in that platform. I think Bill Gurley at Benchmark, but also other VCs will later draw and outline this, or say, hey, we really believe that Uber generates network effects. And what he said was, hey, when you have more drivers join the platform, that increases the geographic coverage in terms of availability of cars, which means that riders have to wait for less time in order to get onto a car. On a parallel note, because there are more riders joining the platform, drivers earn more money, and as a result, more drivers drive the platform. So again, this flywheel keeps turning, and so it generates this, what people consider a network effect, where the more riders join, the better product for drivers, and vice versa. The net effect of that perspective is that it's a winner-takes-all market. What that means is that if you're a network effect, it means that as more people join, your product gets better. Then as you become a certain level of scale, if you have 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70%, for example, then the inevitable dynamic is that you will naturally crush your competitor over time because your smaller competitor doesn't have those effects. And then the whole market becomes a winner takes all, in which case there's only one player left. And once you have one player left in the market, then that means that you have the ability to set price and you have monopoly power over the category. And that generates a certain dynamic and calculus, which is that if you believe that you have strong network effects, that means it's going to be a winner-takes-all market, which means that eventually you're going to make a lot of money Therefore, it's okay to spend a lot of money now, right? To get to that size. And I think that has been true, right? If you look at Uber and Lyft today, post the pandemic, Lyft and Uber are both executing at the top of the game in terms of ride hailing. But because Lyft is just a smaller company, because they raise less capital, the truth is that Uber is able to slowly inch up on Lyft because the product is better when both services are in town. However, what we've realized over the years is that these network effects only work at a city level. And what that means is that at a city level, if you are in San Francisco and you have the best product in San Francisco, you have the total market share, it doesn't mean that you have a better product in Singapore, right? Because as a rider in Singapore, I'm not thinking about whether you have a lot of availability of cars in SF or if everyone else is using Uber in SF. I only care about the cars that are available in Singapore. And so what that means is that there are very weak network effects across cities, but a very strong network effects within cities. What I think Uber discovered was that it is very expensive because network effects are not happening across those different cities. So basically what was happening was that Uber was not just fighting against Grab in Singapore, but it was fighting Gojek, right, in Indonesia, also fighting Didi in China. It was fighting every single fast follower company around the world. And so there's an interesting dynamic, which is that Uber, which is very strong, was actually starting to also lose market share in America because they were distracted, right? The entire HQ was basically saying they're fighting not just Lyft in America, but everybody else. And so I think the sale of the company made sense for Uber because it allowed them to actually end up doing two things. The first thing they did, obviously, was that it lowered their cash burn and allowed them to focus on the core market they wanted to win, which was America. And that was a smart thing to do. But the deeper strategic thing they did was they basically helped choose and anoint, from their perspective, a market leader. You don't want to have 100% of only two or three market players that are fighting intensely for a city because nobody's going to make money. But if you're able to own 20 to 30% of the company that's going to eventually become the number one, then 20% to 30% is worth way more than 100% of something that's stuck in a price war.
Let's also talk about then, with the benefit of hindsight, now that we have 2020 vision, who do you think benefited the most after the acquisition?
Uber and Grab both benefited from this. I think the biggest loser from this was Gojek, actually. So for Grab, obviously benefited because under the local network effects, having Uber's assets, but also customers and social drivers fold under it, gave them more market share. And then that more market share again made the experience better for both riders and drivers. So I think that was a great push in its markets. I think Uber also benefited, right? Because not only are you withdrawing, I think, the continued cash burn that you're going to make over the next 10 years to compete, and but it also gives you the strategic focus, the focus on your core markets, which they would later have to clean up a lot of their work in the US, but also gave them a valuable stake, right, in the business they felt was there. And if you looked at it, they had massive valuable stakes, not just in Grab, but also in Didi and all these other competitors where they eventually exited the market. And they did this exact same approach across multiple markets. So I think I want to recap. This is not a one-off thing they did in Southeast Asia. It is something that Uber is doing in all of the markets they decided to pull out of. And this obviously was to Gojek's detriment, right? Because if you are in the romance of the three kingdoms, you want the other two kingdoms to be at war, and then you go focus and build out your thing, right? Because then you have space, right? But then if you have one conquer the other effectively, then you're down on a one-on-one match.
Absolutely. So now let's just talk about last question, which is the future, right? What is the future for Grab? To some of the people who are listening, they might not be fully aware, but Grab previously did a push, for example, in investments. But recently, they mentioned that they're closing down their investment arm. And I think previously, a lot of people think that an app which is able to command large user traffic is likely able to pivot that traffic to different products accordingly. But I think based on just examining Grab and the success of the investment arm, it doesn't seem to hold true, at least for them. So in light of this, right, what do you think is the future for Grab then?
I think for the Grab team, they must be thinking of, I think, the three core questions, right? Which is, how do we look at this from a country perspective? How do we look at this from a service and revenue perspective? And how do we think about this from a competitive perspective? I think the geography aspect, I think, is very well understood by experienced operators, but I think it's underappreciated for people who are thinking about this for the first time. The truth is, Southeast Asia has dramatically different GDP per capita or wealth of the individual citizen populations. And a straight way we are saying it is that I think the richer the average citizen is in that country, the more willing and they're able to pay for ride hailing, right? Because the alternative is straightforward, which is the time value of money. So for example, America is one of the richest countries in the world, and it's by no accident that ride hailing was invented in the US, because citizens had a long-standing behavior using taxi cabs for decades. And because of that, there was a very common expectation amongst users that they knew the norms around using taxi cabs and using private vehicles to get here and there. So if you go to the other end of the spectrum, then obviously the economy is not yet advanced, for example, to be using ride hailing as a common norm or behavior. The same actually applies within Southeast Asia, right? Because we have different modes of transportation. We also have different GDP per capita. I think what's interesting is to see these super apps try and make a decision about, are they really focused on a driver? Or are they really focused on a rider? So I think what we've seen is that I think the super app around the drivers have been a little bit more straightforward, because for them, this is a way for them to earn money. And so other incremental ways for them to make more cash actually has turned out to be a relatively straightforward way to build out that chain of cross-sale revenues from the app's perspective. From the consumer perspective, it's actually a little bit more trickier, because when you pull up your Uber app, your Grab app, your Gojek app, the truth is you just have to swipe and you can swap to any app that you have as well, right? So you can switch to TikTok, you can switch to Shopee or any Lazada to buy something else. So actually from a consumer perspective, the Grab app is not necessarily a super app, because actually the iPhone or the Android home screen is the super app. And the most easiest way to say it would be, if I was Grab driver and I switch on my Grab app, the Grab app is there switched on the entire day, right? Because it's using mapping, picking up new fares, I'm leaving reviews, the app is there the entire time. For most passengers, you pull out the app to reserve a ride, you forget about it, you didn't notice the notification going off, so you're late, so you turn up, you look at your app again to quickly make sure it's the same vehicle, pop in, you change your app to your email or WhatsApp, and then you're not paying attention for the entire time, and then you disembark, right? I think there's a lot of thinking right now about what it means to have that chain. Personally, I use the Grab Pay to sometimes use the pay for my haircut, because I already have some money in my wallet anyway, because I'm using it to travel from here to there. So if it's available at the transaction, I might use that to pay. It's a small adjacent service with not much revenue. It's available piece of data to have, right? So the tricky part, I think, from the consumer perspective is chaining all those small bits and pieces where you're competing against every other app on your store to create that logic chain that's there.
All right. Awesome. That's actually the last question that we have for Empires.
Go.
Once again, Jeremy, thank you.
Okay, thank you so much.
Joining us next is Jason, who'll speculate with us for another possible acquisition for Grab, Foodpanda.
I'm an investment analyst since my career starting. I worked in IB before, then I progressively went into PE, private equity. And from there, I worked in pension fund, worked in a family office. My boss was actually one of the Rocket Internet alumni. So he himself was one of the founder for one of the Rocket Internet ventures. So I learned a lot more stuff from him on all these startups stories.
Wow, yeah. That's cool, man. And Just share with the listeners, what exactly is Rocket Internet? So for those who aren't too familiar, why is it significant?
So it started by the brothers, just the Samuel brothers from German. Their business model is basically replicating the fastest growing startups in US and replicate it all over elsewhere in the world, whether it's in Asia or in Europe. And in hope that with this copycat model that the US guys would acquire their business, and this is how they would exit. One of the earlier stories was Groupon, and hence they venture into e-commerce, which was Lazada, which was eventually acquired by Taobao. right? And right now, Foodpanda and Delivery Hero.
By the way, Delivery Hero is the listed parent company of Foodpanda.
So Delivery Hero is basically the global platform for food delivery only. And this is specialty, right? They focus on one sector and they scale horizontally throughout the geography and exit out large enough for an IPO or sizable enough to be acquired.
Now let's talk about Grab. All of our listeners, right, they basically went through these few episodes to give them context about Grab, how did Grab grow. And the last episode for Grab, right, would end right where Grab acquires Uber. And then that's where it's widely known, okay, this is where Grab has finally become an empire, really dominate, yes, with exception to Gojek. We are going to talk about what happens after. And I think that one of the interesting talk that's happening right now is a possible acquisition in the horizon. And I think you wrote about it very interestingly and you shared some context, right? What is this possible acquisition that's in the horizon and what do you think triggered it?
When you're no longer at a startup stage or in a scaled-up stage in a sense, or even in a mature stage where you cannot grow organically anymore, you would want to acquire to grow, right? But in the internet companies space, is a bit also peculiar in the sense that because companies like Grab or Foodpanda, you're essentially a middleman, right? Where you cannot control what your riders deliver or the kind of experience that you can control for your customers, right? Hence, it makes sense for them to acquire assets in a sense that in Singapore case, right, they acquired recently, just a few months back, the taxi company. And the idea is that you want to control the assets that you own so that you can deliver the best customer experience for your rider. In the case of Delivery, they acquired Jaya Grocer in Malaysia, one of the largest grocery chain. Because groceries is perishable products, so it's a bit risky to hand it off to a gig worker. All this middleman problem is hard to control your customer experience, which makes sense to from being asset light to become asset heavy, and also to lower their costs, right? Because instead of paying third party, right, all the cost is now within yourself, right? So it's also one of the way to control the cost and increase their profitability. And hence, it's not very unsurprising that they are going through this route in acquiring all this traditional brick and mortar business. And in the case of Foodpanda, right, it's a bit 50-50 because you are not acquiring a brick and mortar business, right? But then you are basically acquiring another of your competitor, which is in the same space, right? Which has the same customer experience that are not top, right? I'm sure there are a lot of people complain about all your deliveries got delivered wrongly. So it's 50-50 in a sense that it possibly will go through because the pricing or the valuation is cheap enough, back of the envelope, right? Based on my calculation, you are essentially acquiring for just one times of the revenue, right? And hence, even the recent announcement by Foodpanda themselves that they are laying off more staff, right? So in a typical merger, right, once you acquire, you want to optimize your cost, right? Typically, people retrench staff post-merger. In this case, right, they retrench staff pre-merger or pre-acquisition. I think they know what they are doing in the sense that they want to reduce the fat so that it makes sense to be acquired off, to be sold off to whoever wants it, and hence the lower valuation currently. This is just my speculation.
So now let's like walk through all of the numbers, right? You have this amazing calculation. On LinkedIn, you share like all of the different numbers based on your own assumptions. And maybe you can walk through what are some of these calculations that you have.
Yeah, so Delivery Hero, all these are public information, right? But as public as they are, they do not segmentize their geography very well. In the case of Delivery Hero, it's by region. So they have Asia, they have MENA, they have US, and they have Europe, right? Whereas in Grab case, they have mobility, delivery, and finance, and others, right? Only like this, right? So you can't really go deep. What I did is just reverse calculating. So what really consists in your Asia business, right? So after doing some more readings and research, Korea is one of the big chunk because they have acquired their Korean business a few years back. And all these high order value countries in Korea, in Hong Kong, in Taiwan. So these three countries are not the countries as what they publish in the news. where they want to divest Asia or Southeast Asia countries, especially Vietnam, right? You thought that Vietnam is inside, but then it's not. Because Vietnam is part of their South Korean JV venture. It's still owned by the Little Hero. Then I estimate how large is the actual countries that are listed. And from there on, in a way, calculate that, okay, if, what is the actual price to revenue, right? Price to sales that they are trying to sell. My first calculation, less than 1x. Doesn't look right, doesn't look right.
For context, a German source mentioned to Jason that Delivery Hero could be sold for around 1 billion euros, which Jason believes is a little too low given the numbers. See, the Asia region of Delivery Hero reported $1.8 billion in revenue for the first half of 2023. If you estimate it uniformly, possibly it could make 3.6 billion euros for the entire year. If the Southeast Asian business represents about 30 to 40% of the business, that amounts to about 1.4 billion euros of revenue. A 1 billion valuation is only 70% of its yearly revenue, which seems a little low, at least based on his research.
A few more publications out there done by all these research analysts also in a way prove that around 1x revenue, which is the correct number. So it's a very good deal. Right now, normally you want to transact at 3x revenue. And in this kind of, I call it platform business.
Yeah. Interesting. We've talked about, okay, there's a possible acquisition, which is Foodpanda and Grab. And then we also talked about a possibility why this might be the case. It's like kind of Grab moving asset light to asset heavy, just cause there could be an assumption that Grab has maximized all the asset light approaches that it has. So now it needs to drive quality down and maybe it wants to own assets. And everything just sounds great, right? But now can we talk about the biggest winners and losers here?
In a deal like this, it's a win for both parties between Grab and Foodpanda, right? Foodpanda is able to cut off the things that are... Because so one interesting, if you look into Delivery Hero or their regional segment, right? Asia is actually their slowest growing region. This is very surprising. You expect Asia to be fast growing compared to US, MENA or Europe, right? So it probably translates to a shift in trend, right? And in Foodpanda case, I just want to sell off my least growth segment. Also the least sizable segment, right? Because the market that listed is not your South Korean won, your Hong Kong dollar, or your Taiwan dollar, right? So all these developing markets currencies that are translated to the euro, it means nothing, right? So it's a win to them if they can be able to focus more on their core markets, right? And it's a win to Grab because to Grab, the Southeast Asia market is their core, right? And it allows the Grab to be more focused into these markets. In my post, I mentioned about Lion Man, Thailand, right? It's going to IPO. In fact, this could be a reaction to this whole news currently. In Thailand, Lion Man is the dominant player and not Grab, right? With Grab and Foodpanda merge, right? Could this disrupt Lion Man's market in Thailand, right? So strategy-wise, it could be definitely a win for Grab, just even from the price point of view, right? Yeah, if I look at losers, right? A lot of, if you read the news, right? Definitely they will say consumers lose the most, right? Because you have one dominant player there right now, right? But I drill down, right? Volatility, right? My option is still, I can take a real cab, right? I can take a MRT in your case. I can take a bus, right? So many options for me, right? So they cannot just simply raise their price because there is still a market price in everything, even in food delivery, right? It's a tough market, right? Not just because between dine-in and delivery, there's also drive-through in the case of McDonald's. So there are so many options as a consumer to get my food. And yeah, and it's talking the balance on how eventually, from business point of view, how basically the market size is not that big enough already. Consolidation is meant to happen. And all this macro effect of inflation, the fact of the matter is, when it comes to all this as a consumer, as a user, I have still much more option as compared to what's out there with Grab currently. One more loser I want to pick up, all the gig workers, all the riders, right? It's an obvious loser. But I just want to point out one thing, right? What were they doing before Grab and Foodpanda exist, right? So these are new jobs created because of Foodpanda and Grab, right? And it's a bit harsh to say that once there's a consolidation and they lose their job, because in fact that these are new jobs being created. So we should look at a bigger picture to say that is there really a net job loss in that sense?
Exciting. Honestly, I just can't wait to see how this plays out.
I think I am. I have my seat warm up now already. I think I can be in your guest, if you should get
You're a lao tiao. You're experienced already.
Yeah.
Just another Wednesday. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Awesome.
Bye-bye.
If you want to learn more about our guest, you can find the link in our description. In the next episode of Empires, we'll explore Studio Ghibli, previously called the Pixar of Japan, until it eventually came into its own and became the only studio to ever win an Academy Award in Asia so far.